It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, healthcare costs are still rising, but what power does an employer have to change that? Our guest says maybe more than you'd think. First, the State Department of Justice released a new plan this week aimed at combating the growing problem of elder financial abuse. That's when older adults, along with other vulnerable individuals, are targeted by caregivers, family members, or in some cases strangers, and either coerced or manipulated into giving their money away. In some cases, the money is simply stolen or the person is the target of a scam. Our next guest is here to talk about what's included in the new plan and how it might help stop elder financial abuse. John Hendrick is the director of the Elder Law Center and Elder Financial Empowerment Project for the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. John, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Well, before we get to these recommendations from the Attorney General's task force, talk about the problem of elder financial abuse. How much are we seeing this?
Well, it's increasing and it's highly underreported. Based on national incidence studies, we estimate there are 35,000 cases in Wisconsin every year of persons over 60 that are victims of financial crimes. And we know that the most prominent place to report is Adult Protective Services. Some people report to law enforcement, some people report to our project, but Adult Protective Services gets the most calls, and they get about 1,000. So that's one out of 35 cases. 34 out of 35 are not reported to anyone.
Talk about some of the most common forms this kind of financial abuse might take.
Well, most commonly, the perpetrator is a family member. So 60% of the reports are family members that are victimizing someone in their family. And one of the most common tools is the financial power of attorney. And many people use a financial power of attorney for the convenience and to have someone help them with their finances, but also it can be abused. And that's 12% of all the reports are using a financial power of attorney.
And is this usually the case where, if we're talking about a senior, they're at a point in their life where they feel like they can't manage their finances anymore and need that little bit of extra help from maybe a relative?
You know, it can be both. Sometimes people who are asking for help will choose the wrong person, and they'll have a guardian, a conservator, or an agent under a power of attorney that actually victimizes them. Of course, most family members and most trustees are trustworthy people, but some are not.
Are there already laws and safeguards in place before these new recommendations?
There are, certainly. The things we're talking about are crimes. There's specifically a crime that applies to someone who uses a power of attorney. It's called theft by fiduciary. So many times the crime can be prosecuted, but preserving the assets, preserving the testimony, and a lot of the things that are addressed in these new recommendations are really very much needed.
Talking to John Hendrick with the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups about this new task force series of guidelines on elder financial abuse. And let's get into now what is in this plan. First, I understand it would allow securities professionals to notify the State Department of Financial Institutions or other agencies if they suspect financial exploitation. How does that fit into the puzzle?
That's very helpful. Under current law, banks have an immunity that they can make reports of financial exploitation and they can refuse to accept a financial power of attorney. But this expands that to security professionals. And for people who have a great deal of assets, they're probably invested in securities, and these are the very people that have a chance to prevent the financial exploitation.
So this is telling them if you see something, say something, basically. They don't have to take things at face value?
Absolutely. And in addition, it gives them the grounds to delay or refuse a transaction and to refuse to accept a financial power of attorney if it is suspicious. So that's very strong protection. And at the same time, it gives them legal immunity so that they cannot be sued for the decisions they make if they're in good faith trying to protect someone.
And there are enhanced penalties coming from the task force here for people who commit elder financial abuse. What would that look like?
Well, there already in the law, there are many penalty enhancements, and hate crimes is a good example. So if someone commits a crime and they do it for the purpose of discriminating against someone because of race, there's an enhancement. And this would be similar, just to show the seriousness of how society looks at stealing from our older adults.
What else stands out for you in these task force recommendations?
Well, a couple things. The idea that in a criminal case, the district attorney would be allowed to ask to freeze the assets of the perpetrator. One of the biggest problems we run into is even when someone does report a financial crime, and if indeed it is prosecuted, and some of the police departments and some of the prosecutors are very zealous in pursuing these cases, but once it goes through a criminal case, a lot of times the assets are gone. In this case, if you were able to freeze the assets of the perpetrator, that would keep those assets available. And then if the court orders restitution 1 or 2 years in the future, the assets will still be there. So that would make a big difference.
Now, I imagine the best thing here would be to deter this from happening in the first place. Do you and your organization have advice for seniors and family members to set up financial power of attorney and other arrangements to have transparency, to make sure that this kind of thing can't happen?
Absolutely. Financial power of attorney is a good example. Two things that can be done are, first, the financial power of attorney should prohibit gifting. That is the most abused provision. People think they can make gifts to themselves, and you want to make that clear that that is not a power that the agent has. And then also to allow other family members to be informed of what's going on. So it's not just one person. If you perhaps make a mistake and choose the wrong son or daughter or nephew, that other people know what's going on. So those are two good protections for financial power of attorney.
And I understand your organization has a hotline to help people out with these issues?
That's true. We encourage people to call us if they're victims of financial crime. We do serve victims over 60, and we have an 800 number, which is 800-488-2596. And so we help victims of crime over 60.
If there's a family member, maybe somebody under 60, another child, a sibling, whatever, are there warning signs that they could watch out for that financial abuse might be going on?
Absolutely. Sometimes they'll see a change in the behavior of their family member, their friend. Sometimes they people at banks will notice that there's an unusual financial pattern. Somebody who always paid the same bills in the same amounts, they start withdrawing large amounts of cash, and sometimes the warning signs are apparent at the financial institution. And in an extreme case, somebody may not have money to buy their medicine, to buy food, and it may be affecting their health. And that's the first warning sign that you see that something's very wrong, and eventually it turns out to be financial exploitation.
So for that third-party person, not the the senior themselves who might be being defrauded, are there actions they can take?
Absolutely. Both banks and family members have the protection. If they call us or they call Adult Protective Services, those calls are confidential. And they also have legal immunity if they report in good faith. So we encourage people to call us or call Adult Protective Services or call law enforcement, but please speak up and don't worry that it will cause problems later. It's more likely that these are not being reported. That's where most of the problems are.
As we wrap up, do you see these new recommendations for the task force, this new plan, as something that's really going to make a difference?
I think so. In the cases that are prosecuted, the ability to preserve testimony, to videotape an older person before they may sicken, or they may have memory problems, or they may die, that's going to be a big advantage. The Department of Justice having a financial auditor to help prosecutors, because these are complicated cases. So all those things, I think, are going to help. And the main thing is for people to watch for warning signs and to report. So we get those 34 out of 35 unreported cases, at least get them into the system.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Hendrick is the director of the Elder Law Center and Elder Financial Empowerment Project for the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. He joined us today to talk about the plan unveiled by the State Department of Justice aimed at cracking down on financial abuse of seniors and vulnerable adults. If you or a senior you know needs assistance recovering from this kind of financial abuse, you can call the group's toll-free helpline at 800-488-2596. The cost of healthcare is continuing to rise, and with the Affordable Care Act still facing challenges, some are looking for solutions that don't involve government policies. In Montana, a former insurance company official was picked to manage the state's employee health plan. She made some big changes that led to big savings that could be a model for other employers around the country. Marshall Allen is a reporter covering healthcare at ProPublica. Marshall, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Well, Marshall, you have been covering a lot of different aspects of what drives healthcare costs, and you keyed in this edition on this story from Montana. Set this up for us. Tell us about Marilyn Bartlett and how she got into this issue.
Well, there are 151 million Americans who get their health benefits through their employer, and employers have not been pushing back against high healthcare costs enough. And so, you know, if you've noticed or other people in your audience may have noticed, your take-home pay is getting reduced because employee compensation is increasingly going to healthcare costs instead of our wages. And so, for various reasons, we don't have as much money in our pockets. Marilyn Bartlett was an insurance company insider. She was kind of in the twilight of her career, about 64 years old, when she took over the Montana Employee Benefits Program. Now, this program was covering health benefits for about 30,000 Montana state employees and their families. And the program was going broke. And so they were losing so much money every year that they really needed somebody to turn it around.
So she comes in, she wants to make changes, and then she starts saying, okay, well, how much are we paying for particular kinds of hospital services, hospital benefits, that kind of thing? And she found what?
Well, so Marilyn is an accountant, and she also, you know, keeps asking questions until she gets answers. And so what she wanted to know was, how much is her plan paying all the different hospitals around the state? And so, you know, your listeners may have heard some of these stories about outrageous hospital bills, and some hospitals charge a lot more than other hospitals for the exact same services. And so what she did, she and her team did an analysis of how much they were paying all the hospitals. And there are about 11 large hospitals in the state of Montana. And what they did is they compared what they were paying the hospitals to what they pay Medicare. And the reason they did that, Medicare is the government's insurance for people who are disabled or over age 65, and Medicare actually publishes its prices. And so, you know, hospitals don't tell you what they charge for things. They just charge an extremely high amount, and then they give a discounted rate to insured people. But you really can't know what it is until after you've paid it. And so she compared the Medicare rates that they were paying to how much they paid the hospitals. And what she found is that some hospitals were getting paid about twice as much as Medicare gets paid, and others were getting paid about five times what Medicare gets paid. And so she decided, okay, I'm going to get all the hospitals in the state to take less money. I'm going to set the prices, and the price is going to be around twice the Medicare rate, and they can take it or leave it. If they want to see the patients who are part of our employee plan, they need to take the lower rates. And so she started this negotiation process to force the hospitals to accept the deal that she was offering.
Now, before she even got to that stage, it sounds like it was really hard to find out what they were paying to these individual hospitals. There's this black box of costs on healthcare.
Well, it was difficult, and you would think that the employer plan, now this is a self-funded plan, which many of the larger employers around the country self-fund their benefits, which means they actually pay the bill. The insurance company manages the contract and administers it, but does not pay. The employer pays. And actually, technically, the employees are paying out of their compensation. And so she couldn't get answers, though, when she wanted Cigna, her insurance company, to tell her exactly how much they were paying to each hospital. They actually had to leave their contract with Cigna and find a different company to help them really analyze their costs. And so once she analyzed the costs and saw the variation, then she had to press them to take less. And so a lot of employers, you know, they don't ask these kinds of questions. They don't demand their health care costs keep going up. And so, you know, Marilyn would say, and other people would also say, other experts, that employers have just been too passive and they haven't been pushing back against the industry enough.
So she has a pretty good pool of employees. Hospitals definitely have an interest in continuing to serve this pool of employees. But what kind of pushback did she get as she had this basically take it or leave it option? We'll pay you this rate, twice what Medicare pays, and not more.
Well, you can imagine that the high-priced hospitals did not like this proposal, right? And so they went to the governor's office and tried to lobby for other proposals that would not include taking a haircut on their bills. But she pushed back. And so, you know, the lower-priced hospitals, of course, signed on to her plan. For them, it wasn't much of a change. But there are about a half dozen of the higher cost facilities that refused to sign on. And so the first thing she did is she took her findings about the price variation to the different state legislators, and she showed them, hey, look, we're paying some hospitals two times the Medicare rate. We're paying others five times the Medicare rate. We just want the high-priced hospitals to lower their price to what the lower-priced hospitals get. When that didn't work, she said, I'm going to take it to the media, and I'm going to tell the media that some of you are high-priced hospitals. And that actually, she said, got about five of the last six hospitals to sign on. You know, they really didn't want the public pressure about their high hospital costs. And then the last hospital that held out was called Benefis Hospital in Great Falls, Montana. And when Benefis held out, what they did is they called in the union, and they got the union to do a campaign to call the CEO, call the board members, call the executives for the hospital, send them postcards, send them emails, and basically bury them in hundreds of messages saying, please take the state contract. You're not going to be getting paid any less than anyone else. You're getting twice what you take from Medicare. So take the deal. And eventually the hospital gave in and took the deal.
Talking to Marshall Allen from ProPublica, he is sharing the story of one major employer, the state of Montana, taking some initiative, negotiating down its health care costs, and maybe an example for other employers, state and private. Marshall, part two was prescription drug costs and the battle against the spread. What did she find out and what did she do?
Well, so the spread, you know, you wouldn't think that these type of schemes would really happen in healthcare or in any business, but it's really quite the norm when it comes to paying for pharmacy benefits. So employers and the health plans contract with what's called pharmacy benefit managers. They manage the drugs that we get through our employer benefits. And pharmacy benefit managers are notorious for this scheme, is all I can call it, called the spread. And basically what they do is they tell the employer that it costs, say, $40 to fill a prescription, when actually, say, it costs $20 to fill the prescription through a pharmacy. And they keep the extra $20. So they basically misrepresent how much it's costing to fill prescriptions, and then they keep the balance. And so what Marilyn did is she dug into her pharmacy contracts, and she read the fine print, and she saw the clauses in the contracts that allowed for the spread. And then she said, I'm going to find a pharmacy benefit management company that will give me a deal that has no spread in the arrangement. And by changing the spread and taking the spread out of the contracts and signing up with a new pharmacy benefit manager, she saved millions of dollars for the healthcare plan.
So how much has the state of Montana and I guess ultimately their employees saved by these efforts?
Well, I mean, it's been a dramatic turnaround. So the plan spent about $200 million a year when she took over. The hospital billing changes alone saved them about $1 million per month. And the pharmacy benefit costs ended up saving them millions more in the first year they made those changes. And so basically, they turned that plan around in about 18 months. It was controversial because the hospitals didn't want to take less. The pharmacy benefit manager didn't want to take less. And she had to fight against the system, unfortunately, to make this happen. But, you know, she was a very strong leader, very savvy woman. She's an accountant, so she knew the numbers. And also, they had to improve because the plan was failing. And so they really had no choice but to make the changes.
And the big question...
And, you know,
I want to jump in because we're just about out of time. The big question is this a one-off, or are you seeing other employers, maybe other public employers or private employers, looking at this and saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should take a closer look at these numbers?
Well, so Marilyn is taking her show on the road. She's getting calls and doing consulting in other states with other employers who want to do something similar. And what she would say is that any employer absolutely can push back. And we should all be asking, all employers should be asking for an itemized breakdown of what they're spending and expecting the healthcare system to justify the cost. We should expect that we're the ones paying the bills and we have a right to know what we're paying for.
One concern might be that those hospitals in particular might need that extra money from one source because we see reports of them having basically a lot of unpaid bills, either having to provide charitable care in one way or another or having to write off bad debt. Is this something that could hurt hospitals down the road?
Well, I spent a whole year last year writing about all the wasted healthcare spending. It's estimated that about a third of all the money we spend in healthcare is wasted. And so I did talk to the hospitals in Montana, and they said that they've still been able to meet their financial projections while taking less money, and that, you know, they really had not been hurt by the reduction in the payments. And so they were able to make the care they provided more efficient. And at least the one hospital I talked to, and I also talked to the Hospital Association, said that they had not had complaints.
We'll leave it there. Marshall, thanks for sharing the story with us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. That's Marshall Allen, healthcare reporter with ProPublica, with us to talk about his reporting on what employers might be able to do to keep healthcare costs down, and this story he reported on from Montana. Issues surrounding race and racism are a big part of life in the United States, whether we want to talk about it or not. From poverty to education to mass incarceration rates, racial disparities are a big part of the story. And our next guest says one of the biggest challenges in confronting racial inequality is getting white people to talk about it. Robin DiAngelo is a consultant and trainer on issues of racial and social justice. Her latest book is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, your book comes out of years of teaching in higher education and then in workshops and seminars for businesses and others. What do you mean by this idea of white fragility that came out of this?
Well, the term is meant to capture kind of two key parts. Fragility in that how little it takes to upset us as white people. So for many white people, the mere suggestion that being white has meaning will cause umbrage and defensiveness, much less generalizing about white people as a group. But the impact of that defensiveness is not fragile at all. It's a kind of weaponized hurt feelings, a weaponized defensiveness, because it pushes people of color and other white people who want to break with white solidarity, it pushes us away from challenging one another.
And you have a target audience in mind, and it isn't what people might think of when they think of white racism. It isn't a Ku Klux Klan member, say. You say one of the biggest problems you see is people who are racially progressive among white people.
Yeah, I often kind of facetiously say white progressives are my specialty, and that's because I am a white progressive. And when I first applied for a job to lead primarily other white people in discussions of racism, I thought it was a really simple matter of open-mindedness. And I am so clear, you know, close to two decades later, that open-mindedness identity as open-mindedness tends to function to keep us closed off, in fact, right? To the degree that we think we're, you know, free of racism and good to go, we're going to put our energy into making sure you see us as free of racism and good to go. And none of it really in where it needs to go for the rest of our lives, which is deep and ongoing critical self-knowledge, mistake-making, risk-taking, relationship building, and actual strategic anti-racist action. And I like like to say that niceness is not anti-racist, but many white progressives think this is just a matter of being nice and friendly.
Right. You seem to come back to a theme of two different meanings of racism. One, that, okay, there are some bad people who have racist views and practice them and directly oppress people. And then what you were alluding to there, an idea that, no, this is a, it's a structure, it's a process, it's a history that that all of us are kind of caught up in.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally this, the structure that we're all in and that we've all been socialized in and that we can't help but participate in. But it's a highly adaptive structure, right? I mean, we continue to have racially disparate outcomes by every measure. In many ways and measures, they're increasing, not decreasing. And yet most white people individually, and definitely most white progressives, see ourselves as free of racism. So we have to ask what's going on. And I think one of the most effective adaptations of the system of racism to the challenges of the civil rights movement was to reduce it to a really simple formula. A racist is an individual, not a system, who consciously does not like people based on race, must be conscious, and intentionally seeks to harm them. And that definition exempts virtually all white people from the system we're in and from looking any further at ourselves.
So for that white person who reacts to, to a conversation about racism with that definition and thinks, okay, well, that's not me. There are other people more racist than I am, so no worries there. What do you say to them about how to think about it differently?
Yeah, you know, I've been doing a lot of work lately with tech companies, and overwhelmingly the employees are very, very young, around in their 30s. They've been raised in this kind of colorblind idea, and they have no skills whatsoever to think critically about racism. And the very few people of color that work with them, and black people in particular, are in a lot of pain. Because if I can't think critically about how my race has shaped my life, I am not going to be able to hold how your race has shaped your life. In other words, if I can't tell you what it means to be white, I'm not going to be able to validate what it means not to be white. And that's going to be very unsettling to kind of challenge that very unracialized sense of self that I have. And so the people of color that are around us can't really talk to us about their experiences, much less any kind of unaware slights that we perpetrate. You know, most of the kind of racism that, that leads to incredible levels of stress for people of color day in and day out is not the really explicit stuff. I mean, I would never use the N-word, and I would never march in Charlottesville, but I'm really clear that my obliviousness and my racist framework. I mean, you can't grow up in this culture and not absorb racist messages, but they come out in very subtle ways. I mean, subtle to me, but they're not subtle to people of color. And that's that daily climate that they're having to navigate. And that comes from well-intended people like me. And it's one thing to be well-intended and not be aware, but when someone does point out something you weren't aware of, you need to be receptive. It's a kind of, oh my goodness, I would never want to say or do anything racist, but don't you dare tell me I just said or did something racist.
Talking to Robin DiAngelo about her new book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. And I guess a defensiveness is what I'm hearing you talk about there. The idea that, okay, if someone's a white progressive and says, okay, racism is bad, and if they're called on racism, that puts them into category of bad person, and that's hard to deal with.
Yeah, you know, in addition to kind of a sense of exemption, right? I mean, individualism is a very precious ideology in our culture. It's really only granted to those of us who are white, you know, when we're thinking in racial terms. And so we just see ourselves as unique individuals, and we expect that that's how everybody else sees us. But, you know, people of color see us, you know, yes, you're an individual. and you're also white, and it has meaning. You know, you can literally predict whether someone will survive their birth and how long they'll live based on their race. And we have to be willing to grapple with the collective shared messages that we get as a result of being in this particular group, and set individualism aside a little bit, or else use it to figure out how what you see about yourself as unique and special and your particular story, how did all of that set you up into the overall structure, rather than how we tend to use our stories to exempt ourselves from the overall structure.
So a very common response, and you've touched on this, is people saying they're colorblind, they don't see color, not a racist bone in their body, that kind of thing. How do you talk to people who respond in that way?
Well, sometimes I share a story about standing beside a black man leading a workshop, and a white woman said to him, "I don't even see you as black." And he said, "Well, first, is there anything wrong with your eyes? Because I am black, and I do know you know that, and that you can see that. And if you refuse to acknowledge that, how are you going to see racism? How are you going to recognize that I'm having a different experience than you are? And definitely, how are you going to be able to support me around the parts of that experience that are really hurtful and problematic?" It's really a form of saying to someone, "I refuse to acknowledge your reality."
Is there a strategy that you found that overcomes that initial defensiveness, or is this just a doomed conversation from the start?
Well, I mean, one of the things I have going for me when I'm doing a workshop or a talk is that I have some time to lay some building blocks, right? I mean, if we're operating from two very different understandings of what it means to be racist or, you know, participate in racism, then right there we're going to be kind of not being able to talk to each other. But I do try to point the finger inward rather than outward. And so I might, you know, I also, of course, want to reduce defensiveness. So I might relate to the person. Yeah, I've heard that joke before, or, you know, I've also had that thought and felt that feeling. And as a result of my work, I've had the opportunity to talk to people of color about what that joke is like for them, or, you know, what the impact of those feelings are on them. And I've had the opportunity to kind of put the human face to that. And I just can't tell that joke or share that feeling without seeing the face of, you know, my dear friend Deborah, for example. You know, notice that the first thing I did was acknowledge that I can relate to the thought. I've probably had it, the thought or the feeling. But I have some new information now, right? I have personalized the impact of that thought or feeling. And it doesn't necessarily shift the person, but it tends to have them think twice about whether they want to say that again. You know, notice I haven't said you're a racist. You know, I mean, there's a time when that might be a line that must be drawn, but mostly it's not particularly strategic.
We're talking to Robin DiAngelo right now. Her new book is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction? What are your thoughts to what you're hearing? Do you think it is difficult to have conversations about racism? Have you been in a setting where you'd think you had a productive conversation about issues of race? Where was that? How did that happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation about racism and why it's so often difficult to have frank conversations about it. Our guest is Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you talk about race in your home, among your friends, or do you avoid the topic as much as possible? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for this topic. It's interesting to continue this conversation in our country. I I'm kind of offended by the title, you know, about white fragility, because I'm not fragile in terms of my convictions or whatever, but I have a couple questions for the author, because one of my first question is, does she think Jesus was white? And of course he wasn't, but the fact that he is not white, and there are white people who take ownership for his vision and choose to see the world in a certain way, does not mean that they are responsible for racism or racists. And so her title itself suggests that white people are responsible for racism, and we are not. And that's my only comment in response to her.
All right. Jeff, thanks for the call. Robin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, you could. I have a PhD in race relations and white racial identity development. So yes, I'm very well aware that Jesus was not white. But I think rendering him white is one of the very powerful ways that we communicate white superiority. I don't believe any white person can grow up in this society and not internalize a sense of superiority. And research shows that by age 3 to 4, all children who grow up here understand that it's better to be white. And it is better to be white in the sense of the privileges that are granted, the benefit of the doubt, the relentless reflection and centrality, the holding up white people as the norm for humanity, and the example of rendering images of God and his son and mother as white. And again, I just wonder, then, who is responsible for racism, right? I would highly recommend Ibram Kendi, national award winning book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. It is a relatively new idea. It was generated to justify enslavement and genocide by people who we now categorize as white. So I would very clearly like to state that racism is a system created and wielded by white people.
Thanks for the call. I broke up there a bit. I'll go next to Cole with us in Milwaukee. Cole, hello.
Hi. Thank you. First off, thank you for having me on the show. So I just want to add a question for Robin. So I was raised in a predominantly white neighborhood, and I didn't have any interaction with anyone of color, basically. And I guess my question is, how do we engage white people that don't have the opportunity to talk to people of color in racist conversations or conversations about race?
That's a great question. Thank you so much. First, we have to understand the power of segregation and the power of calling segregated spaces good if they are white. Just notice that if a neighborhood is or a school is termed a good neighborhood, the assumption is going to be that it's going to be white. And so in many ways, white people measure the value of our environments by the absence of people of color. Those are incredibly deep messages. And I often think about, you know, that I could live my entire life basically only around white people. And no one has ever suggested to me that anything of value has been lost. I think that we really have to understand that that's active, right? That white space is not a fluke. It's not natural. It's not a result of just, you know, some people like to be with their own. It's the result of decades of policies and practices. And every moment we spend in white space, in segregation, we are being deeply reinforced, not only in the absence of that loss, but in a very limited worldview that's presented as objective and universal. And so what I often offer for white folks who grew up in primarily white environments, in some ways, you're actually even less sheltered from the forces of racism. We often think, oh, you know, I don't know anything. You know, I didn't grow up around people of color. But then who were you left to rely on? I mean, what were you left to rely on for your understanding, right? Certainly not a wide variety of authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships, but really, really problematic representations. And so I would walk them through a series of reflection questions. How did you make sense of that separation if everyone was equal? What made a school good? What made a neighborhood good? What made a school bad? Who went to bad schools? Right. There's a lot of deep reflection that people can do to uncover the really early internalization of white superiority. And we can and do hold diametrically opposed beliefs, right? And the research in implicit bias is also clear about that. At the conscious level, I believe everyone is equal. But at the unconscious level, there's no way I could believe that. Because my entire life, I've been given messages that, you know, some groups of people are more valuable than others. I'm not really sure that that can be denied. I think we all know that some groups of people are positioned in society is inherently more valuable than other groups. So we have to get past this idea that to have internalized those messages makes us bad people. It doesn't. But we do have to take responsibility, because the deeper biases shape our responses and our relationships. They come out in ways that we may not see, but that have powerful impacts on those around us.
Talking to Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Robin, one thing that comes up sometimes here on the show, and I think in your experience, is the idea that talking about racism is in itself divisive and highlights racial differences in ways that would be better ignored. Is that something you come across?
Oh, yes. I did want to add one last thought to the last caller, because I wanted to be really clear. People of color, even if they're not in our lives, we need to change that and build relationships. But there are many, many, many people of color who have written and speak and present and have videos. So the information from people of color is out there. We have to care enough to seek it out. Now, this idea that it's talking about race that divides us is kind of a funny one to me. I mean, we really are already divided by race. I would say not talking about that or grappling with that keeps us divided. And I would just offer a question back, which is, who does that narrative serve? I mean, who is more likely to say, let's not talk about an unequal society from which I benefit? And who's more likely to say, we need to talk about an unequal society from which you benefit? In other words, that is generally not the narrative of people of color. And that should be a clue that it is problematic.
In our last minute or so, you've been doing this kind of thing for quite a while now. Do you see things changing much over time?
Oh, boy. I think what I feel really clear about is, unlike the way I was taught in school to think history is this arc of progress, I think it's pretty clear that systems are constantly kind of having to maintain power, and they get challenged and they shift and then they respond. I think we're in a cycle right now of extreme and explicit racism. I think we're kind of back to a climate in which there is permission, much more social permission, from the highest places of government to be really explicitly racist. We're way beyond dog whistle. And that's also galvanized people. And so it's a constant push and pull. I find my work actually easier. I mean, I certainly get some pretty frightening emails. but I think there's a kind of shock and desperation for a lot of really well-intended white people who just don't understand what's going on. And so there's a receptivity there that I actually wasn't seeing before the current administration.
Robin, thanks for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Robin DiAngelo is a consultant and trainer on issues of racial and social justice. We've been talking about her new book. It's called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. She draws from her experience as a trainer on issues of race. The responses she's gotten from what she says are mainly racially progressive white people on issues of racism. It is fall, and among many other things, that means that fall beers are out, including Oktoberfest beers. We're going to have a conversation here on Central Time tomorrow about Oktoberfest and other seasonal beers. That's tomorrow at 4:15. And you can join in already. We've got a post up on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we want to hear from you. Let us know, is there a particular Oktoberfest beer that you particularly look forward to and enjoy? Or are there other kinds of beers you enjoy this time of year? Stouts, more full-bodied beers, pumpkin spice beers, if that's where you want to take it. You can let us know a favorite brew, a favorite brewery in Wisconsin and beyond. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We can share some of your thoughts. As always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR or get a jump on things and email ideas@wpr.org. Share some beers with us, not literally, but the names of those beers. Again, Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. That conversation coming up tomorrow at 4:15. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network.